Welcome to the third series of the Reworked podcast, brought to you by diversity consultancy EW Group. I'm Rachel Wilson, Managing Director. While I'm on maternity leave, you'll be in the safe hands of our special guest hosts, who each fortnight will be speaking to CEOs, HR leaders, and workplace activists about the steps they are taking to reform and rework organisational culture.
Hello, and welcome to the Reworked podcast. I'm Jane Farrell, EW Group's co-founder and chief executive. I'm delighted, truly delighted, to be hosting this episode of Reworked, where I'll be speaking to diversity and inclusion expert David Rubain. David, you are, in my view, an absolute superstar. And I'm genuinely looking forward to this conversation. You've done so much in your career, your life, and we're going to explore both your professional work and aspects of your social identity and your personal life. So, but would you begin by introducing yourself and covering your career?
Well, for most of my career, I was a lawyer. I trained as a solicitor. I was, because of my own experience, I'm a disabled man, my own experience of schooling, I was very interested in understanding, first of all, education law, because I wanted to act for individuals and children, and also the experience of exclusion and a disadvantage, mainly for young people. So I trained as an education lawyer and practiced as an education and an equality lawyer. I was a partner in that area in a medium-sized law firm, and then I left to become the first director of legal policy at what was then the new Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is the current regulator for equality and human rights in Britain. I joined just when it started, I had a range of responsibilities, but principally I was responsible for navigating the Single Equality Bill, as it then was, through Parliament to Royal Assent when it became an Act. After that, I left practice to become Chief Executive of Equality Challenge Unit, which... and I did that for 8 years. It was the UK higher education sector's equality and diversity policy and research agency, where we ran a range of programmes and initiatives for the sector. And I left until it merged into another organisation. And now I do something a little different. I run the Conservatoire for Dance and Drama.
Fantastic. What a fabulous range. You've also written a couple of books, I believe, and...
I do write quite a lot, law books and other things, and I also was appointed as a visiting professor of law last year at Birkbeck, which allows me to do a bit of teaching, and actually a real benefit for me of that is to having access to other people who can think with me and write and develop programmes around issues still to do with equality and diversity, but particularly I'm interested in identity and allyship, and how unity can be used as a force for change. That's my particular interest in that area.
Fantastic. Thanks, David. Now, you and I have been friends for over 30 years and
yes.
done some really interesting work together too. But can you articulate precisely why diversity and inclusion is so important to you?
Well, I think it's... So, part of my... like all of us, I have lots of identities. As I mentioned earlier, I am disabled, and I'm noticeably disabled. So, what I mean by that is people can see that I'm disabled just by looking at me. And therefore, their approach and reaction to me is significantly informed by that. Certainly when I grew up in the 60s as a disabled child, that was probably a dominant experience for me, I would say. I'm also the child of immigrants, and my parents were Arab Jews who came from Iraq and Syria. And I think all of us to a certain degree can think of ourselves as other or different, but that was informative to me, and I became curious as to why, I'm not even sure it's as straightforward as why we're divided, but it's more about how we can sort of park people by identity, and that people are treated in certain ways or thought about in certain ways, consciously and unconsciously, and therefore there are consequences to that about how our lives are, who our relationships are, what our relationships are, what choices we make or what choices we feel we have to make. And I became very fascinated by that. Probably it's fair to say, because of my particular experience of schooling, very angry about it. Because most of my schooling was in special schools, which at the time when I was a child was the default position for all disabled children. And I mean, there were some things which were fun about it, but by and large it was kind of structured warehousing. When I left after my O-levels, which is what became GCSEs, I left special school with two O-levels at grade C, which is just bare pass. Actually then went to the local comprehensive and did a lot better. It was through that process and then going on to university and wanting to understand how all this happens that really has meant that I don't think I could have ever avoided being interested in these kind of broader issues, because it was so central to my experience.
Yeah, and it's such a powerful story. And you also ended up going to a very, very prestigious university, didn't you? How was that?
I left special school at 16 with two O-levels, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I think the expectation was that I would go into a care home eventually. Certainly there wasn't much thinking about me working, let alone studying. But I liked ideas, and I approached the local comprehensive, and they were very welcoming of me and encouraged me to come and do O-level retakes, which I did, and did well. And then A-levels was the next thing, and I did well. And I didn't even at that point have any idea about university, or anything, let alone university, but they encouraged me to apply to Oxford. And for me, that was just unheard of. I'm not even sure I ever made a choice in the ordinary sense of the word, but they were strongly enthusiastic. So I agreed, in the absence of having any other idea about what I would do, and I got in. And I chose to do politics, philosophy and economics because, for me, that was the subject which was most proximate to my wanting to understand the world and how it operates and how people are affected by the world. And law came after that, because after PPE there, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but my tutors there thought that I would enjoy law. And it was at the time when strategic litigation was begun to be used by civil society organisations, NGOs, to affect change. So, I mean, in the US, they've done it a lot through, well, in key case was Brown v. Board of Education, which was driven by the NACCP, or the NAACP, the National Association the Advancement of Coloured People, which was a major black-led civil rights organisation, to end segregation in schools, which was a victory in the Supreme Court. And there were many instances there, and then over here, Shelter, the housing charity, and others began to use it. And my tutors said, well, we think you didn't like it. So I did. I became a lawyer, and I loved it for that reason. It suits my way of thinking as well.
Fantastic. thank goodness for your strength and resilience and determination, and those teachers in that comprehensive school supporting and pushing you and all of those things.
An aside, I am a major fan of comprehensive schools. Yes. I think they are extraordinary because of their, you know, even if it's just from my own experience, of their the sort of decision to keep your mind open about how far anyone can go. Because to look at me and my experience when I was 16, why would anybody think that I would go anywhere, really?
Yeah.
With two O-levels at grade C.
Yeah, so powerful. Yeah. I'm hesitant to ask you the next question, David, because you have done so much and in so many different sectors in different ways, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Choose one thing that you are particularly proud of that you've done in this space.
Well, I'm going to... I thought about this. And I'm going to pick the works, a piece of work we did at Equality Challenge Unit, which, as I mentioned, worked in the HE and research sectors. And there are... all of our work there was evidence-based. So all of our programmes and our activities were based on thoroughgoing qualitative and quantitative research. And so we had and have a lot of data about underrepresentation and exclusion for both staff and students. And there was, and to a certain extent still is, a chronic issue of an underrepresentation of women in STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, maths, yeah, and medicine. Even though, for many years now, many, many more women have studied those subjects at undergraduate level. So if you look at what's often called the pipeline, the pipeline is more leaky. There are more women drop out between undergraduate, graduate, doctorate, postdoc, lecturer, professorship than in other subject disciplines. And so we developed a program. It was actually before my time that it was initiated, called the Athena Swan Charter. Athena, because she's the goddess of knowledge, and Swan, which was an acronym for Scientific Women's Academic Network, Athena Swan. And it was doing, when I joined ECU, it was doing reasonably well, modestly. About 30 or so universities did it. It was entirely voluntary. It was then turbocharged because of a decision by the chief medical officer, Dame Sally Davis, who made it a requirement that universities who wanted to access quite a large amount of biomedical research funding, that they had to be Athena Swan Silver Award holders. So that sort of shook up the sector anyway, and developed it further. But there was a point at which, because of all of this, and of course the HE sector is global. Students and staff travel and work internationally. It was attracting a lot of attention, and it was successful from other countries. And there was a time at which we were beginning to have conversations with HE sectors in other countries. And there was, it's probably fair to say, a wariness from the ECU board about the extent to which we should focus on that and whether it would mean that our attention was diluted from improving conditions in the UK. My own view was that I thought that we would get greater leverage from taking it internationally. And I was supported by key members of my board in that. And as a result, it now operates in several other countries, and it is a comparable instrument, systemic change program, which is transferable. And it means that when you're driving change for underrepresentation in the UK, you can leverage change in other countries and map progress in that way. So probably because I've always thought that looking at systemic underrepresentation as being the most interesting, because it's much more than just people being nasty to each other. Most, you know, often people are not being nasty to each other, but they're still underrepresentation. I thought to have an impact in that way was extraordinarily powerful. So obviously this wasn't all my doing. I was lucky in that we rode upon progress which was delivered by Dame Sally and others, and interest from key university leaders and board members, and obviously my team at ECU who pushed it forward. But we were able to do something I think quite extraordinary.
I agree. I didn't ever know, by the way, what it stood for, Athena Swan. I knew of it, of course. I think it's really great, that phrase about turbocharging. There are those moments, aren't there, in sectors and in organisations where great inclusive leaders can think, aha, right, I'm going to grab this moment and run with it, and that's very exciting. And I and that point that there was some money attached often helps, doesn't it? But it's not only that. And that understanding of systemic inequality and all of those things. That's a great example. Mm. Congratulations, actually. It's really transformed the way that higher education. Or what higher education has done. I mean, obviously, still a long way to go,
sure.
And actually, you'll know that still an enormous amount of work to do in terms of racism and tackling racism on campus and in terms of representation. And actually, you did some work on racism as well.
With the experience of Athena Swan, we built a race equality charter. And the thing about that is some people said, well, let's just join the two. But what our research showed us is that the particularities of underrepresentation and disadvantage on grounds of race were not the same. So the Race Equality Charter focused on pedagogy and curriculum, whereas Athena Swan didn't need to. So there are clearly similarities alongside other systemic change programmes. But the focus was important. There is something else that occurred to me about it all. I remember when it was turbocharged, or when it got a boost by a major funder linking funding to success, there were times when I had some university leaders in my office who it sort of raised the temperature, because instead of success in the charter being good, but a badge which people could show, there's nothing wrong with that, it actually began to matter for the bottom line. Mm. And Athena Swan is a rigorous program, and so some institutions or departments didn't get the award, at least not the first time round. And after it was linked to funding, I would have some vice chancellors in my office threatening to sue us, because ECU was tiny compared to them. Mm. And I wasn't at all fazed by that, because I missed litigation. I kind of hoped they would, but they never did. But it was interesting. I don't think of those people as bad in any way. No. I think they were anxious. But it surfaced a lot of what, in my view, are some of the barriers to change. It was anxiety on their part.
Great. I like the idea of being thinking, bring it on, a little bit of litigation there. I'd also, it'd be great if you could talk a little bit about, I know you do a lot of consultancy work, Premier League and in lots of other places, and for EWG, of course. Could you give us again an example of when you've, perhaps some of your work on leadership that you've done?
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the HE sector, and I think there's an enormous amount of good work there that's done, but there are also the same structural issues as you would expect in any other sector. And for some of my time, I would do. I was chief executive of ECU, but I wanted to, and I remained involved in program delivery. And because the time I had available to do that was limited, it would tend to be work with senior leadership teams. And I remember that one instance where I was asked to come in to do some work with an institution where basically the leadership had fallen out with each other to quite a detrimental, severe way, where the chair of the board had fallen out with the vice-chancellor, and there were allegations of harassment and discrimination also within the institution, and that had severely affected an institution. And universities are very large businesses and with turnovers of hundreds of millions of pounds, and that, so the impact is considerable. Mm. And what they didn't need me to do was to ascribe who was at fault, because all of that had been resolved for better or worse otherwise through their processes. Mm. But what they needed was a kind of lessons learned, and what do we need to move on. How do we need to understand what happened?
Yeah.
So there was an element of what you might call restorative justice type work there. And it was a mixture of you know, practical, what's good practice and what's policies, but how could we have reached this situation where, despite none of us intending to, problematic and indeed bad things have happened. Mm. And it's kind of thinking about that in a structured way, mm. With goodwill, which in many ways was tremendously rewarding and very interesting.
Yes, that's such great work, isn't it? Mm. When and as you say, some of the when we're invited in to do that kind of work, and where some of the process, it's not a dispute that there has been sexism and racism or whatever it is that's happened. It's our job is to move
yes.
it forward.
Yeah.
It's such a privilege in a way to do that work.
And it's a learning experience for all of us.
Indeed. I'm conscious that we're nearly out of time, which is
yeah.
it's an outrage. But I'm really keen that you tell me a wonderful, wonderful story of how you came to have a very good friendship with someone. And that would be great if you tell
sure.
that story.
Sure. Well, I'm happy to, partly because I it's important. Is that it's very important to avoid any sense. I've long understood that thinking about equality and diversity is absolutely not about who are the good people and who are the bad people, and that we can all inadvertently make mistakes. And I'll talk about the time my friend Layla and I. Layla is a British, black, Nigerian heritage woman, and she and I are both part of this leadership network. And on one occasion, some years back, we were at an event at part of this leadership network. In fact, it was a conference in America. I think it was in Los Angeles. And we were in a room, and it's full of very forthright, high-achieving people who have lots to say. And, you know, people are not backward in coming forward, and there were lots of discussions and some arguments, and there was one of these going on, which turned into quite a significant argument. It got a bit edgy at times. And the argument was between a white American Jewish woman and a black English man. This was the argument. And I was in the room along with Layla, along with many other people, and they were sort of going at each other, really. And then afterwards, we went, you know, there was a tea break or something in the proceedings, and Layla and I just happened to be next to each other, and we were chatting about what we had seen. And what came out of that conversation with Layla was that Layla had spotted racism from the white Jewish woman, and I hadn't. And I had spotted anti-Semitism from the black English man, and Layla hadn't. Now, that's not all that was going on. There's lots
yeah.
going on.
Yeah.
But I had, I suppose, what I had spotted sort of stereotypes and tropes which I would consider anti-Semitic, along and within a whole range of things, including some legitimate points from both people and whatever.
Hmm.
But I hadn't. What was interesting to me was that I hadn't spotted this racism. And this is from somebody who has been committed to the agenda for all of my life and who would think that I'd be fairly well attuned to it, but I hadn't spotted it. And so it was clear to me that there's something more to understand here. And Layla and I kept talking, and then we decided to stay talking as friends, not just about that, but about everything. And so now we have, you know, monthly dinner, really, just as a catch-up about our lives. And not, as I should stress, because we want to keep talking about that event.
Yeah.
But it's but because we decided we just really liked each other.
Mm.
So this, yeah, maybe that's all I need to say about it.
Well, I think it's such a powerful story around listening and learning and staying in that uncomfortable place. And it could have easily been, couldn't it, as you were sitting next to each
mm.
other, that you'd never have spoken to each other again. You would have
mm.
both gone off thinking
yeah.
bad things about each other. But actually, you both engaged with listening and learning.
Yeah.
And so in terms of inclusive leadership, I think that's a fabulous
mm.
example. And just a huge thank you, David, for
you're very welcome.
talking to me today. It's been an honour, and I'm really grateful. So thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Delighted. Thank you.
I hope this episode gave you some ideas that you can replicate in your own organisation. We'd love it if you could leave a review and also subscribe to Reworked so you don't miss our next episode. Diversity and inclusion at work has never been higher up the agenda. The EW Group team includes learning and development specialists, facilitators, researchers and analysts, all with deep expertise in equality, diversity and inclusion. If you think we can help you rework your own culture, please get in touch.